Everybody knows about the Buddha, right? So do I have to start with the Four Noble Truths? Huh? Yeah, no, but I'm just wanting to know how basic I should get, right? If you all know all about the Four Noble Truths and all that, I don't need to give a big overview. Yeah? Okay. Now, so what I am trying to do today is to give you a very quick snapshot into not the whole of the Buddha's teaching, but basically to show you how the three pillars, which is the Dhammamantra, how does that fit into the overall picture of the Buddha's teachings, okay? Anybody knows what the three pillars are? Sorry? Dana, did you say Dana? Dana, Sila, and Bhavana, right? That is so basic to the Buddha's teachings, except that not many people actually know that this is equally foundational to the Buddha's teachings as the Four Noble Truths. Okay? In fact, this is one of the foundations of the Buddha's teaching. Now, so when we look at the Four Noble Truths, you know, the first Noble Truth is there is suffering, right? Dukkha. Actually, I don't know how many of you know that the word is translation of dukkha is suffering. Actually, the word, sorry, is it tea? Yeah. I don't drink tea. Can I just have hot water? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I can't sleep at night, too much caffeine. Thank you. Michael, come in, Michael. Yeah, just hot water will do. Yeah. You okay, Michael?
Yeah.
We just started. Yeah. So when people say that there is suffering, the first noble truth, and then the second noble truth is there is a cause of suffering, and then the third noble truth is, what is the third noble truth? Yeah, this is the sensation of suffering. There is a cause, and then there is suffering. Okay, and then this is the fourth noble truth, is the path to the cessation of suffering. Okay, now the word dukkha, which is a Pali word, actually means fundamentally unsatisfactory. Do you know that? Yeah? Because suffering, people often say, oh, the Buddhist teachings are so pessimistic, you know, there's not always suffering, sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm joyful. But basically what the Buddha is saying is that things are never permanently the same. Change is one of nothing. You know, change in nature, change in time, change in our feelings and everything. So basically he's saying that because change is natural, it is inherently unsatisfactory, right? And from that point of view, therefore it is unsatisfactory. So he's talking about foundational dissatisfaction. Okay, not that the food is bad or cold and things like that. But the reason it is fundamentally unsatisfactory is because of human nature, right? Because things change. We always want things not to change. Right? People say to me, oh God, the weather is so bad today. It rains so much. I said, well, the plants are happy. I'm happy. I don't have to water the garden. Right? And then they say, oh, it is so dry. Right? Because, you know, there's always, so the Buddha says, there's always inherent dissatisfaction with whatever state that is, because we want it to be otherwise. And Thich Nhat Hanh, who is, as you know, the Buddhist monk, says, it is not change or impermanence that makes us suffer. It is our attitude towards change that can, right? You don't like it, you make you unhappy. I always tell people, they say, why do you worry about the weather? I say, because I can't do anything about the weather. Huh? I don't like the rain, it's still going to rain. I like the rain, it's still going to rain. Okay? So, that comes to the second noble truth, which is, there is a cause for suffering. And the cause for suffering, the Buddha says, is our attitude. Right? The cause of suffering is in our mind. And one of the fundamental teachings that the Buddha has is you can hold the world in your mind, in your hand. Because it's how you perceive it, right? So the cause of suffering, or I would use the word dukkha because I don't really like the word suffering, it doesn't really consider it. The cause of dukkha is not dukkha per se, it's not the unconscious. It is the way our mind judges that situation. Okay? Then he talks about the third noble truth, which is that dukkha can be extinguished. And y'all got to be careful because the word cessation is that you can actually stop the state of dissatisfaction or unsatisfaction. You can't. Right? But you can extinguish it, that means you can reduce it, you can diminish it. How do you see actually that things are always changing? Right? It's like trying to ask the ocean not to move. Right? So the Buddha talks about, thank you very much, reduction of our own personal suffering. Okay? And that leads us to time. That leads us to the fourth noble path. The fourth noble truth is there is a path to reduce this suffering. And this is where a lot of people know it. Now, the reason is called Eightfold Path is because there are eight factors in this path. Now, unlike in a lot of religion, especially I think you would be familiar with the Catholic religion, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not do this, thou. It's more of a commandment, right? In the Buddha's teaching, it's not a commandment. He talks about the word right. Now the word right, anybody knows the Pali word for right? Sama. And some of the books you'll find, they will talk about sama, Now, right is not a judgment thing, it's not evil or bad, it's not right or wrong. Sama, right means skillful. So, what is skillful is what frees your mind from remorse, okay? If you do something and you go home and you're restless and you cannot sleep and you're stressed, that is not right, because you know. So this idea, in some of the texts where they say, okay, you know, if you do bad things, then you come back with a squirrel or a rat or a lizard and things like that. Adan Sumido, who is one of the, you know, the Western ones, you don't have to wait till you come back to a rat or lizard. You do nothing bad, you go home, you cannot sleep, you watch television, you condemn the thing, you know that's not right. So the idea that the Buddha lives in the Eightfold Path is you know for yourself what is right, thought right. Okay? And that's why when it comes to the Buddha's teaching, the big thing about the Buddha's teaching is personal responsibility. Okay? The whole basis of the Buddha's teaching is about you take the responsibility for your own state of mind to reduce your own suffering by practicing skillful action, skillful thought. Okay? So that is Buddhism in a nutshell. Now, what about the three pillars? The three pillars is dana, sila, bhavana. Now what does dana mean? Sorry?
Generosity.
Yeah, generosity, what else?
Offering.
Sorry?
Like offering.
generosity is often God.
Okay.
What else? It's not a test, so you can say anything you like. Okay. So what is dana? Generosity? Offering, yeah, they're all the same, offering, then generosity. What else? Okay, we'll leave it for the moment. What is sila? What is sila? The second sila. Yeah, but what is it? Sorry? I know you know the April, but I want to know what is it. It's like people tell me first noble truth and dukkha and suffering. What is it? I don't know. The Buddha says, and that the first sermon is this. Don't believe things because I tell you. Don't believe it from the book. Don't believe it because the teacher tells you. And they got a PhD in the word, you know. Believe it if you try it yourself. The whole of the Buddha teaching is based on your own experience. That's why he says what you learn for yourself. So, what is morality? What is right? What is right action? Sorry? How is that morality? Yeah, so they all come under, but my question is, why is it morality? Why is it not called handicap or blue or green? What I'm trying to ask you to do is not to remember the Buddha's teaching by heart. I want you to reflect on it. Okay? And that's why when I talk, I always tell people, please don't invite me because I'm very confronting. But I'm also quite funny. No? How many have you been listening to the Dharma talk for how long? 2 years? Yeah, 2 years? Put up the hands, 3 years?
4 years.
5 years? 10 years?
Well, when did you first come?
20 years ago.
Okay.
Oh, she's already my, she's my, when I see her face, I know I'm in the right room. Yeah, 20 years. 20 years, and you all cannot explain to me why is it called morality? Huh?
Because how we communicate
with one another. In the personal field? Yeah, but why? I know you're talking about what it is, right? In the personal field, giving to other people. I'm asking you the question. It's a very fundamental question. Why did the Buddha call it morality? Why did he call it Kinkor, or Fox Point, right? So we really went through Kinkor.
But isn't that just like, why do we call anything at all? Like, just a name.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see that. Okay, so you're saying it's just a name. Morality is just a name. Okay, so morality is just a name, okay? Okay, well that's as good as any answer, right? Okay, just a name. Okay, what is Bhavana? Bhavana.
Mental cultivation.
Yeah, mental cultivation, what does that mean? You know that if you give an answer, you're going to be asked the next thing. What does it mean?
Meditation.
Right. Now, Bhavana falls under this mental culture and discipline. Okay? Now, there is no such word in Buddhist practice called meditation. That's an English word. Like, suffering for dukkha, that's an English word. The word is bhavana, it means mental cultivation and discipline, because it's what you're doing. You're cultivating your mind to still. You need discipline, right? You need to cultivate through right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, okay? And then you have the wisdom factor, which in Pali is called panya. And it says, right understanding, right thought. Right? Why?
Why? I'm sure Michael can answer that. My friend Michael is very good at the Dharma. He's a natural Dharma. So why would wisdom come under right thought, right understanding?
So how do you get the wisdom? Sorry, what does it
mean?
Stephen says you got to have the wisdom to see the right outcome. How do you do that?
Mindfulness.
How do you do that?
Mental culture.
How do you do that?
And you need to practice right space and action and livelihood.
How do you do that?
You learn it as a kid.
You learn it as a kid.
Then someone tells you.
It's just a name.
And you're all right.
Now, the main thing to understand first is that the Eightfold Path is not linear, okay? They're all circular, okay? Think of it as the wave coming in from the ocean everywhere. You do not know where the right action starts with, but thoughts and all that kind of thing. You cannot say, and some people say, no, man, today I will practice right thoughts. Tomorrow I'll practice right speech, okay? And then the next day I'll practice right action and so on. So the Buddha says you actually need the wisdom, the right understanding, right? To know what is the right action, to know what is the right thought, what's the right speech, right? You need the clarity of mind. So to get the clarity of mind, you need to train your mind to quiet it down, right? And then when your mind quietens down, then you can see that you have a right understanding, you know what is the right speech and the right action. You see, so the three pillars actually are triangulated. Okay? Dana, Sila, Bhavana. They're triangulated. And then they come as scaffolding to support wisdom and compassion. Can you see that? Can you see how the Eightfold Path and the three pillars, they are like the same family? You can't say who begins. So you need the clarity of mind. You need the clarity of mind to get the wisdom and understanding. Once you get the understanding and wisdom, then you know what is the right action, right? And the reason he calls it morality is not a philosophical morality, like, you know, how they were debating with the philosophers. Morality is something opposed to ethics. You know what's ethics? Huh? Ethics is like if you, like me, I belong to the psychological society. We have an ethics code of conduct. Right? You must not overcharge a client, you must not do this, you must not do that, you must not cut your hands, you must not. That is usually man-made. Morality is human value, right? And so when the Buddha talks about morality and the right action, right speech, and right, it is something that you know intuitively as a human being. And that's why, in a sense, the Eightfold Path is never a command. The Buddha did not say, you should not say stealing. He said to you, you know that stealing is unskillful because it will hurt the person who used whatever you take from them. So you think for yourself, how would I like to lose this one? Could be your girlfriend, could be somebody. So like my daughter, when she was very young, said to me, Mom, would it practice is very, very hard. And I said, why? He says, because they don't give you any rules or regulations. They just tell you to reflect for yourself, right? Right. And he says, that was when she's 18. He says, at 18 years old, you just want to be told, don't do this, don't do that. But the Buddhist practice is, think for yourself, right? What frees your mind from doing more. Take personal responsibility. So that's why the three pillars support this idea of what is personal responsibility. Okay? Now, the difficulty nowadays is most of us, very fashionable, we all only know this. Bhavana, right? Not only that, we only know mindfulness, right? Not only that, we only know the commodity of mindfulness.
And not only that, we only know it for mental health, stress reduction, right? Physiological, all those things, it's fine. The Buddha will say they're all skillful things. But this is, you can see the whole of the Buddha's teaching. Right? Mindfulness is one of the 8 factors. But in the West, it is like the Buddhism. Now that is wrong understanding, wrong thought. Because to have mindfulness, and the Buddha does not talk about mindfulness, which what the Western psychologists and others talks about. He talks about right mindfulness. Okay? Otherwise, I mean we are mindful of so many things, right? We're mindful of hunger, we are mindful of this and that. But he's talking about right mindfulness is the mindfulness that frees you from remorse. Should I do this? Should, and when you know that it's right mindfulness, basically it's a universal human capacity. Huh? If you cross the road and you don't have right mindfulness, you know what happens? You get killed. Right? It's as simple as that. You don't feed your baby, it dies. Right? Like nowadays we have things like, should I breastfeed, should I bottle feed, should I this? Just feed. Okay? The right mindfulness is to nourish your child. Okay? So the Buddha would say, clear your mind, see what the child needs, give the child what the child needs. That's right mindfulness. So the right mindfulness gives you the right action. But now we're so in a politically correct society, we never debate the right action. You know how we debate? The right label. Right? So we should actually, the Buddha should have another section if he was living in 2019. Right? Right label. Right terminology, right gender, right this, right that, and it's really right. Right? Because we forget already that these are fundamental truths. Right? If you clear your mind, you know what is right. Okay. So what has that got to do with the 3 pillars? You notice that dharana is not here? Now sila is under here, morality. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Bhavana is under meditation. Where does dharma come from? Generosity, compassion. Dharma means love, kindness, compassion, generosity. All the things that come from the heart. Right? Now where does that come from? It's not in the Eightfold Path.
It's a manifestation of.
What do you mean, Steve?
Well, you can. It's like when you're a little kid,
uh-huh.
You have this already.
Yeah.
With embrace. Mm-hmm. And you're just joyful.
Uh-huh.
And then as an adult, we protect ourselves, and then through the teaching, we can rediscover that.
So are you're saying that it is natural for you to be generous?
Yeah.
So are you taping? Oh, don't sit on it. Okay, alright, sorry.
Most children
are recorded, right?
Quite general.
Is it record?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I better not say any funny jokes. But why are you recording? Is it okay if we don't record? Does anybody listen to it?
I'm putting
on our website. I know. Does anybody listen to it? Oh, all right. That's fine. Okay. I will be politically correct. Okay, yeah.
Most children aren't joyful. It's an inherent nature. And then as we experience difficulties, we create barriers to protect ourselves.
Yeah, but we're talking about dana, Stephen. But my question is, why is dana outside his teaching? And at the same time, one of the 3 pillars, why?
Should rediscover it.
Rediscover what?
When you can clear your mind of attachments and greed and anger and be aware of it and not allow it to manifest, then the only thing that can manifest is joy.
But dana is more than joy. Dana is generosity, love, kindness.
That's part of joy as well.
Yeah. Okay.
By giving us oneself without asking for it, you just do it. It's not that you don't even think about it. It just happens. You just do it.
It sounds very easy to do.
Well, first you got to get there.
Okay.
It's not easy.
So dana is a culmination, right, of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
And the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Okay? For example, if you have to be generous, right, the natural instinct, unless you are a child born with that, the natural instinct is, and this is what the Buddha talks about, the personal pronoun. My, me, right? You get my car, my umbrella, my girlfriend, my money, and this and that. So it's very hard for you to give when everything is personalized in you, right? So the Buddha says that if you understand the Eightfold Path, which is this right action, right? Is this right thought? Then you can give, not necessarily of anything in particular, but you can give of kindness. But that's why kindness is in dana, right? Like, you know, Michael is my best friend, right? I always say of him, Michael, gosh, I cannot drive with myself to the university today. It's so hard to get there, training and all that. Michael said, no problem, I take you. I said, Michael, we're running late. No problem, we go King's Cross, right? And then I said, Michael, we're lost. No problem, right? It is the giving of, you know what? Calmness, right? It is the giving of, say, Belinda is stressed, she needs some. She needs somebody to say, okay, you say, don't worry about it. Right? So the Buddha is talking about dana in a very subtle way. Sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes you give donation and all that kind of thing, very easy to see. But the Buddha says that to give truly of dana, you have to clear your mind. Right? And that's where bhavana comes in, the mental culture. Right? And that's where the sila comes in, the morality to do the right thing. Because lots of people, when they give dana, especially you see a lot in your Buddhist temples and other religions. Excuse me. I want my name on a brick. Right? So how big is my name going to be if I give $10,000? Do I have this brick or next brick? You know what I mean? And a lot of people, I mean, that's fine. I mean, the institution benefits. But that is not dana. That is not right action. Because it's an action that comes with intention of attachment of me, my gift, my presence, right? Look at me kind of thing. Dana doesn't have that. Dana is how they describe as, like Stephen Batchelor often says, dana is a very spontaneous action. You think of it as if your foot were to hit a table, your hand will spontaneously go down and rub it. Dana should be that kind of spontaneity. Right? But, I mean, that is very ideal. Most of us are like, dana. But it's okay, as I said, it still benefits. Right? But a lot of dana has the self involved in it, has the ego involved in it, okay? Whereas true dana comes with seeing what is needed in this particular unique situation. And that's why it is over and above all the Eightfold Path. In fact, it is in all the Eightfold Path, right? Because you need the right thought, the right action to be able to give skillfully. Understand? So can you see why the three pillars are the foundation of the Buddha's teaching? And the question about, is morality just the name? Right action, right speech, right livelihood? Is it just the name?
you could call it anything as long as you say that.
Do you think so?
I mean, that's how language works.
No, I'm not talking about language, I'm talking about sila. Are you a linguistic student?
No.
So what he uses the word sila, morality, is like Stephen said, you are born with it.
Okay?
You know, already know what is right action. You already know what is right thought. You already know what is right livelihood. But sometimes circumstances force you to take on a livelihood or some action that is not so skillful. And so the Buddha doesn't condemn you. They ask you to look for yourself. Okay? Like last time when I gave a talk to the legal profession. So one woman came up to me after that, said, Belinda, after this talk, another, I feel very bad. I said, why? She said, I'm a criminal lawyer. I represent people who do bad things. So therefore, I'm not doing right livelihood. Right? So I need to go and give up my job. And I said, what would you do? She says, I think that I should, she didn't want to be a criminal lawyer anymore because she thinks it's bad to say bad people. Right? So I said, well, that's true. It's bad to say bad people. But you know what? It is worse to let them on the street. Right? Without any defense lawyers and all that, and you know our own criminal system. Everybody has a right to defense. Right? Everybody has a right to a lawyer. Okay? So if they don't, there's not going to be a trial. Right? The criminal is going to walk free because it's a mistrial. Okay? They'll kill a date. So maybe as a criminal lawyer, you could maybe persuade this criminal to go for rehabilitation. Right? You have the opportunity to make maybe a difference to their life. Because that is the legal system they need, a defense attorney. But I never saw it. Understand? So a lot of people have a very, very, I wouldn't say superficial, but have a very informal understanding of what it means, right? So they want to give up this and they want to give up that because it's not right. But the Buddha asks you to consider the pros and cons. What happens if all the criminals walk loose? Okay? Unless, of course, this criminal lawyer want to go and change the whole legal system. Right? Yeah. So the idea here of bhavana, the training of the mind to see what is right, what is moral, what is ethical, is very, very important. And that's why they are scaffolding. Right? When you clear your mind, you can see the wisdom of what you're doing. Okay? Right. Now, there's another element that comes from all this, which we hear a lot, but it's not in the Eightfold Path. And that's compassion. So how does compassion fit in? I mean, compassion is now such a buzzword, right? Oh, the person is so compassionate. He is so nice, he's so generous, he's so this, he's so that. And now we have the election coming up, you know. All the politicians are using it, you know. And Shorten says, I'm more compassionate than Scott Morrison. And Scott Morrison says, I'm more compassionate than him. I give you more money, I throw away more money. And Shorten said, I give everybody cancer free treatment. And now it came on the radio this morning, I heard. All the cancer treatment that he's giving away free, it's free. It's free already. Right? So how can that be skillful when you're telling the people, I'm giving you something that is already free? Right? In the Buddhist, from a Buddhist perspective, that is not right thought. Right? He could have said, I'm giving those who haven't got it free, free. But the headline is, all cancer treatment free. I heard it on the radio, and the guy said I had cancer for 10 years and never paid a single thing because it's on Medicare and it is on mine. So they make headlines, right? So that's why I'm trying very hard to introduce the Buddha's teaching into parliament, into politics. Because our politicians do really need to understand what is the consequence of my action, right? Is this skillful? Not is it right or wrong, is it skillful? And the media needs to say that too. What we are writing about, what we are promoting, is that skillful? And I like the word that the Buddha teaches people to use, not that it's right or wrong, but is it skillful? Because when you say right or wrong or evil and bad, that is a very judgmental thing, right? And then you feel very bad, I did a bad thing. But when you said this is not skillful, you're actually focusing on the behavior rather than your feeling, and you can actually modify that behavior, right? Where did you say, oh, you know, I did this so bad and I'm feeling so bad, it's how you feel, and the feeling get worse and worse, and tomorrow I feel worse. But if you said that wasn't very skillful, you actually need to reflect on the action and move on from that. Can you see how important the use of words are? Okay? That kind of word is very important. And the Pali word is kasula, which means skillful, and akasula, which means unskillful. But the idea here is it's non-judgmental, so that a person who does something that is unskillful will then move on. And I use this a lot in my counseling. And sometimes the client says, oh, Belinda, I feel really bad about this. And I said, that was not very skillful, was it? And they said, actually, I like the way you put it. You know, like, it's okay, you didn't know what you're doing, now you know. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's why I'll often say that the Buddha is actually a very, very good psychologist. He's not a god, and he's not anything. He just understands human nature far more than anybody, because he just sits there and reflects on his own nature. Imagine that, right? He sits under the Bodhi tree for 8 years and he gained enlightenment. How? How did he gain enlightenment sitting there? Not doing anything. Because he's a very good observer of human nature. First, he practiced all kinds of training. Yoga, starvation, a lot of ascetic training. And he found that he got sicker and sicker and sicker and weaker and weaker. And he wasn't gaining any understanding about himself. He then understood that it is no point to punish your body to try and clear your mind. Now that itself is a big understanding. Then he decided, okay, I can concentrate, and he did a lot of concentration meditation, which is already in India when he first started Buddhism and all that, samadhi meditation, right? You focus on your mind, you get deeper and deeper. That's how it started. But then the Buddha found that he found it difficult to manage and cope with what comes out in his mind when his mind is still. Yeah. Anybody has nothing in their mind when they're still? Huh? Anybody's mind is supposed to be empty? Huh? I remember I had a person that wanted to come and learn meditation from me. She had cancer. And she's a very strong Catholic. And the first thing she asked me was, Belinda, my priest has a lot of concern about doing Buddhist meditation. I said, yeah, why? What was that? He says, the priest said that when my mind is empty, the devil will get in, right? I mean, it's a real, genuine question. So I treat it with respect. And she said, is that true? She desperately wants to do it because she's only got 18 months to live. She's got brain tumor, she's got breast cancer, and she's got something else. And she's only 38 years old, she's a young kid. So she's very, very depressed.
So she wanted to do it. And so I said to her that our mind is so full of junk that there will be no shelf space for the poor devil to sit. Right? The thoughts will keep coming in because she doesn't believe the previous process. Right? So I wrote her, very skillfully I wrote her a letter of insurance. I usually don't use Dr. Kong, I don't know, but blah blah blah, very impressive, you know, blah blah blah, and all that kind of thing, you know, with website and all that. And I said, this is to guarantee that when Victoria meditates, that there is no shell space for the devil. Right? And that, so I signed, you know, sincerely, Dr. Kong. Okay? She still had that. So she took it to the priest. The priest was very convinced. Okay, you can do that. Okay. Right? And so she did meditation, and I wrote up about her case, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, what she discovered, and because she had concerns about Buddhist meditation, I was very mindful, right? I did not ask her to sit in concentration a lot. I asked her, she was very concerned about her hair, which was beautiful, auburn hair, like Victoria's, you know, but longer and fuller. And it was all really vicious having chemotherapy. So I asked her, I said, you know, I want you to go and sit outside because it was winter. I said, go and watch the trees where the leaves fall, okay? And I want you to find two clouds for me that is the same. That's all the exercise I gave her while I teach her some basic quality in depth. So the next week she came back and she said, Belinda, you gave me a very stupid exercise. You asked me to look for two clouds that are the same. I couldn't find any. They're always moving and changing. And then she said, I watch the trees and it loses its leaves and it doesn't cry. That's part of nature. Right? Change is very natural. And then she added, which was really, really insightful. She said, Belinda, change is natural and inevitable, right? The clouds are moving. So she got insight into impermanence, which is what the Buddha talks about, okay? That is inherently unsatisfactory. She got the insight into the seasons come and go. And then she said that change is natural, right? It is all interconnected. She says, once I come to this realization, that change is fundamental and ontological, very foundational. I lost the fear of the change taking inside me. I lost fear of the personal change. And I made the resolution that when the trees come back with its leaves next year, I will be back with my hair. Right? So she went on like that. She used my tape because she didn't like chemotherapy. It was very hard and so she was not getting the full benefit of it. I said, before you go to meditate, chemotherapy, you meditate, you wear my earphone, and so she actually don't hear the machine. And anybody seen a chemotherapy room? Very cold, it's like you're being on a pathology lab. It's cold lab because they need the x-ray to hit you. And all you do is you cover your face, or the part that you don't, you know. So it's very, very challenging, okay, and she hates that. And so the doctor is concerned that she actually doesn't really get the benefit because she goes in there, she gets so angry. So with the meditation and all that, she did it quite well. And then 6 months later, the doctor from her oncologist said that her tumor has shrunk. Right? And then she told the doctor that she's doing this meditation and all that. The doctor said, look, we'll look after you medically, but whatever you're doing to help your own stress level, to help your autoimmune system, do it, okay? 10 years later, she was free of cancer, right? Completely all gone. So I gave a talk to the Cancer Society, and somebody in the audience said to her, you're a Catholic, how can you do Buddhist meditation, right? Isn't there a conflict? And she was very sweet, you know, I gave her the name Teresa. She said, the doctor looked after my body, my priest looked after my soul, the Buddha looks after my mind, I don't have a problem with you. And she got a standing ovation. She said that clarity of mind which comes from wisdom, which comes from right understanding. And through this simple exercise of just experiencing and understanding impermanence is in the nature of things. And that's why I often tailor the work that I do with people based on the cultural background. I teach meditation to Muslims and all that kind of thing. And that's why I always say to people, you cannot teach meditation or try, and I train a lot of students, psychologists, which I tell them, please go home, don't do this work, because they don't even have a personal practice. And that's where the morality comes in, right? You've got to be ethical in this practice. You need the experience, you need to know how to adapt it to people. It's simple, but it's very powerful. And the ethical action is, do I know what I'm doing? All right? And that's where the dana comes in. Because if you do not know what you're giving or doing, then you're not being generous. Because you can do as much damage by commission doing things as by omission, not being skillful about it. Understand? So you can see what I'm trying to show you is that the three pillars influence is very important in everything that we do in our life, because it helps you to reflect on your own actions. Okay? And the basis of the Buddha's teaching is always about, am I skillful in what I'm doing? And bhavana, sila, dana, then all that just gives you that basis to ask those right questions. The Eightfold Path gives you the basis to ask the right questions. What is right speech? You know, sometimes, I'm sure I've told you stories before, right? Where I remember years ago, sorry, let me finish the story about Therese first, okay? So there was a talk recently in my building, my office building. One of the shop persons ran up to me and said, Belinda, Belinda, I have a message for you. And I said, there was a note from Therese, that's not her real name. She said that she goes to this Sunday market and sells jewelry. And then I don't know how it happened that she mentioned that she was in the same building as me, my colleague from downstairs. And Therese said to her, she's the lady that helped me with my meditation 10 years ago. Now, this is 25 years later. I lost track with her after the talk and all that. So she wrote a note and said, can you give it to Belinda? And she wrote there, dear Belinda, do you remember me? I'm the lady that you helped with cancer and all that kind of thing. I'm still alive. I'm now a grandmother. She's giving back to society. She's teaching and all that. It was, to me, it was such a truth. You know, like, it was just like a voice in me. So she gave me the telephone number. I called her and, you know, we chatted. And she said, having been given that, because the girl from downstairs said, I didn't know that. She just goes to the, she has two cafes. She said, I always thought that the people who own the cafe are so nice. They are very kind, they are very compassionate, and I always wonder, where does that come from? And now she said, oh, Belinda got me there, because she also gives me the Buddhist philosophy about generosity. So it's like the ripple effect, you know, 25 years ago, I just teach us a simple meditation, it wasn't a big deal, right? But it rippled there. And the interesting thing is, the priest that was very upset about her doing, so he got cancer. And he said to her, can you please teach me the same meditation? Because he's seen the effect that it does on her. So again, dana, sila, bhavana. Right? The priest, having seen how the devotees have come through that, has suddenly got the wisdom. Right? Has suddenly understood what the right action was. That she went against him because she trusted me to say it's okay. And now the priest can say that his own thought and understanding is not right. So he gained wisdom. See? Simple, right? It's everywhere in our world. Okay?
Now, I'm going to stop here for one little minute so that you all can ask questions. Right? And then if there's no questions, I'll go on and talk. Any questions? You can ask anything. Don't have to be this, you know, and you can ask any question that you like. When I was starting to do this work, and I started my PhD with, you know, Chief Reverend Dharmananda in Kuala Lumpur. He's passed away now. He writes a lot of books. Okay, he's a late Chief Reverend. Anyway, the first time I went to see him, because he was my PhD supervisor for the Buddhist path, I said to him, Chief, I'm a Sunday school Buddhist. Because my mother would say, okay, this is Disa, let's go to the monk, and let's pray to the monk, and let's give him some money, and all that kind of thing. You know how it is, you go there because your mother says, good. So I said to him, Chief, I don't understand how, you know, to first pray or bow, or do this, and all that kind of thing. So if you don't mind, I'm going to excuse me. So Chief is he is one of the wisest person I know. He said to me, Belinda, do you respect me? I said, yes, of course. He said, well, if you respect me, then you can put your foot in your mouth and you will still be okay. It has to come from your heart. Right? Dana, Sila, Bhavana. Chief understood that I didn't know, I was worried about the form. He's telling me the substance is more important. Understand? Right? So you think about how you yourself practice the three pillars. And then now Chief successor, Chief Reverend Dharmasaratna, he is the one I went to interview because I'm just editing a special issue of mindfulness for the American Psychological Society. And I said to him, Chief Reverend, I said, there's so much talk about mindfulness and all this and all that. And now they use it everywhere. They got mindful cushion, mindful yoga, it's like everything is mindful. It's like the curry of the month, right? The curry flavor of the month. So I said, what do you think? He said, that's because people only understand bhavana to equate mindfulness. Whereas bhavana has to be complemented by dana, which is compassion, love, kindness, generosity, and sila, which is morality. Without that, it just becomes a technique. Right? So when you have bhavana and you're supported by generosity and compassion and right action, what you have is a flowering of wisdom on one hand and compassion. Okay? Does that make sense? So the Buddha's teaching is always circular. There's always no beginning, no end. People say, so which one comes first? I say it's like the egg and the hen situation. It all comes together because every layer of truth. You know? Yeah, that's why the Buddha talks about basic knowledge and then real understanding. But for my client, Therese, when she came, her understanding was meditation can help me to reduce stress, right? That is very common knowledge. Then when she actually sat and looked for the cloud and all that, she really has this very deep understanding. Right? She got the wisdom. Change is natural and inevitable. Now, yes, my thought.
I would like to comment here on the Kasula.
Sorry?
On Kasula. On skilled work.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I think this is the hardest thing today.
Uh-huh.
Because it takes hard work to be
right.
Skillful, and in this selfish society,
right.
Often we are treated unskillfully.
That's right.
By a lot of people who we meet
in
all
right.
walks of life, can start with a stroke assistant or a
yes.
Person who gives you your coffee
mm-hmm.
in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and they overlook this fact, how important skillfulness is.
That's right.
I think anywhere you go. And I would just like to ask you
uh-huh.
your experience,
uh-huh.
how did you manage to persuade people to be more skillful?
Oh, very good question, Michael. You've been listening to my talk, eh? Thank you. And that's a very good question because I put here a colon here.
Because in front of each of the factors of the Eightfold Path is the word right. And people forget that. The Kasula Path. Right? Now, how do I persuade people to come to that? I don't. But what I can persuade them is to reflect how they feel. And this comes from the Buddha teaching. To actually let them experience the remorse that they feel. We all have that. We are born with it. And that's why morality is something inherent in you. When you do bad, you will know. I remember that book, Crime and Punishment, the guy who murdered and killed. Nobody found out it was a perfect crime, but he couldn't live with himself. He was a very good example of somebody who could not free himself from remorse, so he ended confess, right, even though he had the perfect crime. So, very often, I say to them, right, and I see that in my work a lot. I mean, I don't think anybody comes and asks me to help plan a wedding. As a psychologist, the best thing I get is, I'm okay today. But normally, it's, I did this wrong, I did bad, this and that, and all that kind of thing, right? You know what I do that I find it very powerful myself? I recently had a person like that. So, I ask them to quieten down their mind, okay? Until a point where they're quite peaceful and calm, and I say, do you have any thoughts? And they usually say, no, I'm so calm, but it's so peaceful, no thoughts. And then I said, okay, I'm going to introduce thoughts to you. And I usually give them the thought that they just gave me last session, or just this morning, or whatever, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that, and blah. So before I do that, I will rate them, I get a baseline, how do you feel now? On a scale of 1 to 10. Before they start meditation, they'll say 5, right? And then, or 7. And then, after they get quieted down their mind, and they say, oh yeah, I feel very good, it's like 1, the lowest. And then I say, okay, I'm going to give you all the thoughts, you know, I hate this person, and blah, 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 and all that kind of thing. And I say, okay, I want you to introduce this thought in your mind by yourself. Because this is what goes on in our mind anyway. And so they do that for a little while, and I said, now I want you to rate how you feel. It's gone up to 10. Huh? And I said to them, okay, now, can you just note those thoughts? Don't trail after them. Don't ruminate this. No, I hate my boss. Let go. I hate my mother. Let go. I hate myself. Let go. Right? Don't attach to it. And invariably, they will find the strength level drop. So I take the rating. And then when they come out, and this is where you need to let them experience the wisdom and the right one. I say to them, how come you can go from 7, which is very high when you first come in here, you go to 1 when you go down to very quiet, then you go up to 5, which is normal, then I give you all the thoughts, and then you go up to 10, right? That's what I mean. I said, what has changed right now in the last 20 minutes? And then the penny dropped. Nothing, right? They're just sitting there. They're meditating. They haven't even moved. They haven't interacted with anybody. Nobody's thinking of them. Nobody scolded them. Right? And then they say, it's all in my mind. It's the way I perceive it. The second noble truth. Right? There is the cause for suffering. It is the way we perceive things. And it is such a powerful practice. I can't even say how powerful. For us to recognize, A, that we create the suffering in our own mind, and secondly, that we can release from that suffering. And then I said to them, so how skillful it is, you think, that you introduce all these thoughts in your mind? And they said, yeah, not very skillful, because I'm the cause of my own suffering. And that's when they get the experience, Michael, of the skillfulness within their own power, personal responsibility. So from that very small beginning, Michael, I introduced them to the concept that skillfulness is something that we can take into account and deal with it ourselves. It's not some big theoretical, you know, you got to chant 2,000 times or say 10 Hail Marys and all that. That within your own mind, in this 10 minutes, you can skillfully free yourself from mental suffering. Very powerful. Right? Once you get that, then I start to talk to the clients about generalizing it. You know, the person that you mentioned that you hate in your thinking, right? Can you tell me? So I use that as a basis for counseling. But I need, first of all, for them to experience that even though nothing has changed, the condition hasn't changed, they haven't even moved out of the chair, but their mental suffering can go up and down. Now, once you have that, it is the experience of the Four Noble Truths. Number one, there is suffering. Right? It's unsatisfactory. I hate people, I don't like this. And all that. Secondly, there is a cause for suffering, the way I perceive it. Third noble truth, that suffering can be reduced. Right? I can let it go. Fourthly, there's a path to reduce the suffering by calming myself down, by stilling my mind, letting it go, getting some wisdom. 20 minutes, you experience the Four Noble Truths. Right? And that is the level that I want you all to try and experience the Dharma, the Buddha teaching. Don't worry about the text. Don't worry about whether it should be turned this way or that way. How am I experiencing Dharma, Sila, Bhavana and the Eightfold Path in my life? So, well, nobody has questions. Michael, does that help though?
That's very helpful because be nice is great.
Uh-huh.
Because you're conditioned to it. But when you do it consciously, that's even nicer.
Yeah.
And that's what skillfulness
requires
you to do. Because do we know the Australian society, whoever born here and lived here, they're very nice people.
Yep.
But it is like a rot nice.
Yes.
They're nice anyway. But if you are nice because you're skillful, that is when you're starting to realize that you're following the way of Buddha.
That's right. That's why the Buddha says it frees your own mind. Not the other. The benefit is the other person will also benefit and you get this interaction. But first of all, you need to free your mind. But also, as an extension of that, the Buddha also teaches, right? And I asked you, Reverend Dhammananda, that one time, because you know, out of the five precepts that the Buddha teaches, one of them is no killing, right? Actually, the Buddha never said no killing. The Buddha said, do not kill unnecessarily. Okay? And that's because it's against the backdrop of Hinduism, where the Brahmin priest has a lot of animal sacrifice, children sacrifice, and all that. And the Buddha is trying to encourage people to eat. You kill to eat, you kill to live, but you do not kill unnecessarily. But a lot of people take it extreme, as usual, then it becomes no killing. Right? So I asked him, Reverend, I said, chief, if I meet a tiger, and then the Buddha says no killing, what should I do? And Chief said, Chief is very funny, I love it. I really miss him, he died at 90. Chief said, the Buddha teaches you to be kind, he did not teach you to be stupid. And that's great. If you meet an obnoxious person, Michael, don't worry about being skillful. The skillful action is to avoid the person. Right? Get away, free your mind from remorse.
Yeah,
that's skillful. That's why the Buddha says you've got to apply the skillfulness to develop the understanding. I'm not going to make a difference this person like this. Like you were telling us about how the guy wants to rob you. And, you know, I mean, if you went and said, excuse me, you know, Michael was telling me this story about this guy. He was a bit worried that the guy was going to rob me. Excuse me. You know, are you robbing me? And Michael said, no. I decided this guy, I want to get away from him. That's skillfulness.
right? You size up the situation because you clear your mind. You see how even as a non-Buddhist you can apply this, because what the Buddha is talking about is the human condition. That's why they talk about Buddhism as an attitude rather than a religion. Does that make sense? Okay, now I got a question. Who in the last 6 months have applied Dana, Sila, Bhavana in their life? So, yeah, you, Stephen? Can you stand up so that we can take?
Oh, no.
Yeah, but we can't, they can't hear the back.
Oh, I'm not
going to share. Oh, my goodness. That is, well, not very Dana. That's not very generous.
I'll never share.
Okay. If you stand near, yeah, so we can hear. Can you all hear Stephen?
No.
Yeah.
Alright.
Stephen, don't be shy. Look at, yeah.
So, what I've been dealing with, this, my thought.
Sorry, can I tell you what you do? Can I ask you what you do? What do you
I'm a Master of City Planning.
You, sorry?
Master of City Planning.
Oh my goodness, you're the person I need to see. No, I'm only kidding. Okay, so he's a Master of City Planner.
So we have our journey in life, and everyone's journey is a little different. My journey has been dealing with mental health issues. So something I thought about, that, which is the reason that Buddhism attracted me. And so this year my practice has been about being calm. And then to be calm, I have to put into practice of being mindful and being wise. So I don't allow myself to get angry. If I get angry, I let it go. And today's a good example of how it works. As I was walking from my workplace at Waverley Council, and there was these two blokes, men, on the other side of the street yelling. And they... I looked and he gave me the finger, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it's nothing. I just go, yeah, you're an idiot. There's no like hostility or anything. I just kept on walking.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it doesn't, it's like, well, he's an idiot because that's the behavior. But it's no like, oh, I'm going to fight, or there's no, oh, what are you yelling at me for? Or there's nothing there. It's
so you don't need to react to him.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. absolutely nothing. And I thought, well, you know, that if that had happened, you know, 3 years ago, it would have been on. I would have ran across the road. Yeah. So the Eightfold Path is quite powerful. Right speech. I was thinking about being careful what I say at work, at university, with young people. I try to be careful with what I say. I grew up differently. So I left home at 14, and I was in gangs when I was young, and yeah, it was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
My father's an alcoholic, so I lived up in that environment, and then my mother's a bit not all there, so I lived in that environment, so it was quite stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So right speech allows, if I create, it creates the room, the atmosphere around us. Right mindfulness creates the atmosphere around us. And I know the difference is when I'm in old Steve mode, no one wants to talk to me. And I can feel it too. And then when I'm in this mode, it's people just come up to me all the time. It's like, okay, cool. That's all right. Who are you? They're like, oh, all cool, chatty and that. And you meet really nice people. So there's putting the Buddhist Eightfold Path into practice has helped a lot. It's different for you guys, I'm thinking, because I was older when I started. You guys,
you. I don't want to tell you how old I started.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, it's never too old to start.
No, it's never too old to start. But getting the freedom, that's a big one. That mental freedom, yeah, from stress and from anger and greed and all these other things. And then you can really focus on the small things in your life that are still present. Maybe it's looking good, you know, having the best clothes or whatever it is for you. And then if you can free yourself out of that, well, hell, what else can you do?
So can I ask you, Stephen, then how do you stop yourself from being a doormat because you're so nice, everybody take advantage of you?
Yeah, that was the challenge. Uh-huh. So I actually have a person I see,
uh-huh.
and I saw her, a psychologist, I uh-huh. saw her 3 months ago. And my thing was, I told her that, I said, I'm either very nice and I'm belly up and I can't defend myself, or I'm really aggressive and there's no medium ground. So I found that it was actually meditation
mm-hmm.
was what has given me the clarity. So the readings is one thing, and then the meditation is what pulls it together. So I found, because I hadn't been meditating, I'd gone back into the belly.
How does that help you? How does it help?
Well, I had a confrontation with a person I know, and first one, I was quite emotional because of. And I had to leave, yeah. And then I had like 3 weeks between the next meeting, and I was meditating. It was totally different. It's like, not a problem.
So why do you think meditation made that difference?
The sense of place.
Why? You know, I never ask one question.
Yeah, it's in an internal place. Like, it's like sitting down.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it's hard to describe.
Right.
It's a place inside that's calm.
I understand.
Yeah.
Stephen, do you mind if I use you as a role play to?
Yeah.
Do you mind if we share?
Share?
Yeah. I'm very kind. I want to.
Loving kindness.
Now I wanted to know the thing. You know, Stephen has very generously shared with us his, you know, his different lifestyle, his attitude, and all that. Now, can you tell me, because we are on the three pillars, where would the three pillars come into Stephen sharing with us? Stephen, you want to try that yourself?
Compassion.
Where does the three? Yeah, where does the three pillars come out in your own account of where you are?
Compassion.
How is that?
Because it's letting them into a world they may not experience and sharing that, so that maybe when you come across people, you'll have compassion for them. So exposing myself is to allow you to see something you may not see in your own life.
You mean being vulnerable is okay mm. for you, whereas
yeah.
previously you dare not be vulnerable?
Is yeah, that? Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, definitely. My thoughts there. Something
well,
else.
You're getting free counselling, Stephen.
Oh, what else?
I won't even count you.
Yeah. Yeah, you get to a point, and it's still on the journey, yeah, where you get the freedom just to be yourself and being yourself.
So what, being yourself is also what you were before, like, you know, tell the guy to, that's yourself. How do you know this self is better than that old self where, you know.
Well, that comes down to, well, it's a base, yeah, you don't want to be in chaos. Because chaos, that's, you know, death and destruction. You can choose that path, but we haven't. We've chosen the path, a different path, and therefore compassion's important, and therefore sharing oneself is important. Because if you can let go of, share who you are, you can let go of your own fears. So you don't have to be about me and I. Your ego, it gets weaker. That's what you're trying to kill the ego off.
Okay, yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So if I could maybe share, because I think it's a very good example. I think in the case of Stephen, he has practiced Dana by sharing and by being authentic and honest with us. That's his gift to us, right? He did not say, you know, I practice every day and now I'm so good and all that kind of thing. He actually allowed his vulnerability to come out and say, previously, and this is the environment I come from, this is the thing, and this is what I'm learning and all that, right? So that's the dana part, the giving, not of himself only, but the giving of his need to not be vulnerable. Now, a lot of people in interpersonal relationships, in interpersonal communication, this is the biggest obstacle. In counseling, we see that a lot. I dare not say this because they will take advantage of me or they will win, you know. So to be vulnerable, and that's where the bhavana comes in, you've got to have the scaffolding to hold yourself. And that's where the meditation comes in, for you to hold yourself, to say, if I can free myself from anger, right, then it doesn't matter whether the other person is angry, because then you can see your own reaction and their action in real time. That is the right thought, right understanding, right speech. Okay? Otherwise, because if you don't slow down your own process and thinking, right, like you said before, you'd have crossed the road, beat up the guy, and say, oh my goodness, maybe I shouldn't have been doing that. Maybe he belongs to the tribe.
I was quite happy back then.
Yeah. But, so what meditation does for you, apart from the sitting and all that, is it actually gives you a moment in time to be what they call an independent observer of yourself. And this is a very powerful thing, because usually you go, oh, sorry. Right. But when you are meditating, you're quiet, you go, I don't need to respond to that. The guy's an idiot. It gives you that really a pullback position. Mm. And the discipline is not in the meditation. The discipline is training you to stop, observe, look. To give you that moment when you can choose between reaction and response. And even if you have gone over and beat him up, even no. No, even if you decided that this is a case where, like the Buddha says, don't be stupid, right? Yeah. And you decide to do something about it, it is still a response because you made an informed choice. A reaction is when we do it autopilot, we don't have to think until, oh my goodness, right? So that's why it's very important that the Buddha says, we ask you to be kind, we didn't ask you to be stupid, okay? So if somebody says to you, even you're so nice, can you give me $1,000? Say, oh, I'm a Buddhist now. I have a client who had a problem. He was just into Buddhism and all that kind of thing. He parked the car down, somebody backed up his car, and he went up to the guy and said, it's okay, don't worry about it. And I said, why? He said, because I'm a Buddhist. I'm supposed to let go. I said, but you might have insurance, your car is all back. Oh, it's okay. I can let go of my anger. I said, oh, really? He said, actually, I'm very angry with myself for being stupid. You know what I mean? This is not skillful action. This is like playing doormat. Right? Because the guy is quite willing to use his insurance thing. He said, never mind, I'm Buddhist, you know. So that is letting go and letting go. Okay, the idea when you use bhavana, sila, dana is to clear your mind to see what is a unique action needed in every unique situation. Okay, and the other thing that you're talking about, you were talking about what the Buddha says, don't fear the extreme, right? Mm-hmm. Either anger or playing like a doormat and saying, okay, beating up. Right. It's like the Buddha says he went into starvation mode and he finally didn't get enlightened. Yeah. And that's why he talks about the middle path, which is the eightfold path. It doesn't fear the extreme. Yeah, so Stephen, my only advice to you is, yes, it's very nice where you are, but don't forget. And I always say to people, even though we have a bad government, right? Don't throw out the bad government unless you have another government in place. Otherwise, what you get is chaos and anarchy. So your anger, your whatever you had before, have actually hold you, supported you, helped you to be who you are. Like from this 14-year-old to now you're living. So some of it is good. So don't throw out the baby with the bath. Your job now is to be skillful to say, what helped me through? Can I refine it? Can I, you know, change it a little bit?
can I adapt it so that it's skillful? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's how we practice dana, sila, bhavana every day. Be more. Okay? So thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Any questions? Any comments? Anybody wants to share?
I have a question.
You have a question? Okay. For Stephen or for me?
Oh, for you.
Thank you.
I wasn't sure.
Can you stand up so that we can hear you? Yeah.
It's just a question.
Yeah, no, this is for Bhavana, for Kanna, okay?
You're on the stage, right?
Yeah. No, you don't have to, just so that everybody can hear you, that's all. Otherwise, it gets a bit hard for the audience.
So my question is, how to introduce this skillfulness to little kids, like children?
Oh, okay. You got a baby?
Because I just started teaching in preschool, right? So yeah.
Oh, I love that question. I love teaching children. I have two grandchildren, grandson. Right? What's your name?
Alina.
One of my grandsons is 8 years old. And the other one is 6. And this is where the idea that it is morality, not ethics, is because it's inside me. They all know. It's the parents or the environment that says, don't be stupid. You shouldn't trust this uncle or that and that. Okay? But you're not also asking them to be stupid. So what I always do is to role model for them because they are a bit young, right? Then I ask them how they feel, okay? Like my grandson, both of them do meditation since they were 3 years old. And yeah, when I go over there to see them, the first thing I do is, my oldest grandson is Matthew and the youngest son is Nicholas. I say, Nana is very tired, so can we just sit and quieten our mind for 3 minutes, right? If I said that they are tired, it's not going to happen, right? So you got to think, okay. And then they said, and they got to be 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I'm okay now, right? And I said, that's very good. So you slowly introduce, it's okay, right? The concept, you do, when you're dealing with the children, how you introduce skillfulness, is you yourself have to be very skillful. Never give the children meditation longer than what they are capable of, because you want to reinforce in them that they are doing well. So I teach a lot of children who've got ADHD. The first thing I ask the parents to observe, how long can your child concentrate in anything, right? And they'll say, oh, 10 minutes, 15 minutes and all that. Okay, then you give your child, if they can focus for 10 minutes, give them 7.5 minutes, so they feel empowered, so that they feel real. Don't give them 15 minutes and say, mommy, I cannot do it. Always. So when you say, how do we introduce? It's through your own skillfulness. Like with Therese, I know that her priestess got concerns about meditation, right? I know she's got concerns. So I've got to give her an exercise that's creative, that gives her the sense, but without introducing all this Buddhist practice and all that. So you've got to be aware of each child, right? So like my grandson, so we all sit and then I said to them, how do you feel? He says, very good, right? And I said, now do you want to get up? He says, yes. Then they look at their mother and they said, but mommy needs to do meditation. I said, why? He says, because mommy is always so stressed. And I said, yeah, why don't you go and tell mommy that? Can you teach mommy how to meditate? So she put the mother in front of her daughter and said, mommy, breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. And I always let them guide. So every time, one of them will guide. Right? And I always say, that is very good. And is this helping?
Yeah.
And the test of it is, my two grandsons said to me one day, and this is like so amazing because I recorded it. And I know what the difference is in meditation. I said, yeah, what's it? He says the difference is between mindfulness with two L's when your mind is full of things, and mindfulness with one L, when you're just mindful. This is from a 4-year-old. He understands because his mind is full, there's two L's. I thought, my goodness, how did that? Right? Because they got no precondition, they don't care whether there's a 4 noble truths or 12 noble truths. They're just experiencing it. Then, last year my husband passed away. Right? And he went to the hospital and everything. And the grandfather was telling them, you know, when I go, you've got to look after mommy and this and that. And Nicholas said, Papa, Grandpa, your mind is full with two L's. You should be talking to us with mindful with one L. Why don't I teach you to meditate? Right. Now, you know why? You know how they learn? Because they feel, right? They feel that whatever they're doing, they are generalizing it. And I always encourage, can we talk to them? Can we talk to the rock? Can we talk to the I tell them to talk to plants. Right? Like, and they'll say, Nana, why do I have to water plants? I said, I don't know. Why do you think? Because plants need water too. Right? So anything, you can find lessons as long as you yourself are skillful. Right? So I cannot give you a manual, but I'm suggesting to you, be present. Right? Be present to the child. And, you know, and also use a lot of humor. I always find it's all, you can never go too wrong with humor. You know. So the other day, you know, Reverend Mahinda?
Yeah,
he turned 70, so we all went to wish him happy birthday. I asked my grandson to draw a birthday card for him and all that kind of thing. And then I said, usually we give little red packets, you know, like present. And I said to Matthew, if you want to go back and sell spend, I said to Matthew, you know, I was teaching him about Dana, Sila, Bhavana, because they already know a lot of Bhavana. So I told him that we're going to be generous and things like that. So, you know, he said, what do I normally give? I said, well, you can make cards of this and that. He said, okay. Matthew said, man, I always see you giving him red packets. What is that for? I said, well, the monks, they cannot ask for money, right? They take vows of poverty. So I usually give them something on occasions because they need to buy soap and powder and things like that. The Buddha has a rule in the Vinaya that the monks, if they ask a request of you 3 times and you do not follow it up or you forget, they are not allowed to ask again. Did y'all know that? Because the Buddha knows that monks have a very strong influence on devotees. So the devotees forget 3 times, it could be because they're poor, because they do not want to annoy them, or whatever the reason, in the Vinaya rules, you cannot ask them. Right? To make sure that the monks do not exercise undue influence over the devotees, which they used to do in India and Thailand and things like that, right? So I explained to him, that's why I said, I give him on special occasion because they have to buy shoes and socks and all that kind of thing. So he said, I want to give too. So I said, okay, what would you like to give? He said, and I have a box of special coins. Can I put it into a red packet? I said, okay. So he took it, put it there. And when we went to see Reverend Mahinda, he said, Pante, we make this card for you, all is beautiful, but I also would like to make Dana for you. Grandpa says, oh, obviously the grandmother's been talking to you. What have you got in there? He said, Pate, I don't have a lot of money, but I got a special coin, and it's 50 cents. So he gave Pante the 50 cents, okay. Right? And that to me is so special, right? That my grandson understands. You know, he's only got $2 or something. He give away 50 cents, that's like 25% of his savings. Right? To me, that's so powerful. So, simple things. Okay? But teach them by way of stories. The Buddha is very good at telling stories, especially. And the Buddha is very good at telling stories that suited to the person's development. And, right? So children are very, very, very open-minded, right? And the other secret I have, ask them, right? Don't say, you do this, do that. Would you like to do this? Why are you this? Like today, can you turn off the recording?
Can you stop the recording?